And here we are in YouTube land. We're off the hook overtime. Did we all make it? Yeah, looks like we're all here. Great. Welcome, everybody. Our phone number, 802-321-4225, if you wish to join the conversation. And Gila, it seems like you want to do that right away. Go ahead.
Well, yes, actually. There's a thought I had percolating from the end of the discussion. And sorry, we're just air checking YouTube. We're running on YouTube, and so I'm hearing the echo, and it's a little... anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that what Kyle was saying about the infrastructure and the system of the phone lines, and also it's true. I think if the companies can't figure out a way to upscale it, make it more of a revenue generator, they're not going to want to be interested in it. And I think it's almost going to need to become like hipsters are going to need to rescue landlines in the same way that they rescued vinyl.
I like that. If it could be the same energy behind that, then we have nothing to worry about.
Exactly. Like, if you can get, you know, it's become such a status symbol, and I think that if we can, you know, almost bring back the same kind of, like, fun, like, landline phones. Like, you remember when... in the 80s when they had, like, those see-through things and you could see all the wires, they were just the coolest thing that existed. Mm-hmm. And the phone plane that Rob painted in his phone series.
Oh, yeah. Canadian.
You know, if we can make it hip, like, it needs to become the new vinyl. But the other thing it reminded me of was years ago, my dad, who was a firm believer in landlines, he had to call the cable company because the cable was out. No cable, no internet. And he called and he said... the cable and the internet are out. And they said, thank you for letting us know. Are you interested in upgrading to the triple play so you can have your phone service with us too? And my dad said, you know who I'm calling you right now? I wouldn't be able to do that if I transferred my phone service to you. And the guy on the other end was like, oh, I guess you're right.
Touche is the right word to use, I think, in a situation like that.
Absolutely brilliant. But, yes, that's my idea. We need to make landline phones the next hipster cause celeb.
Let's take our first phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime.
Hi, is it me?
That's what?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, before I get to my main point, what was the title of the John Lennon song that you played to close out the show tonight?
That was called Free the People. Bring on the Lucy, I believe. I don't know what that title means, but that's what it's called, Bring on the Lucy. It's from the Mind Games LP.
Oh, okay.
Or CD.
Okay, nice to hear that. About a month ago, I was browsing through my Google search results, and I don't remember now what the topic was I was looking up at the time, but one of the sites that was high up on my list was one of Robert Steele's websites. And at first I was very enthusiastic because I remember seeing him speak at the Hope Conference. Mm-hmm. And I was very excited because he had about 200 book reviews posted on this website and all various nonfiction titles, all different categories, books about computers and history and science. And I thought this is a great resource, really great that I found it. And then I was really shocked to discover he had posted a book review by a guy named David Icke, who's this really lunatic conspiracy theorist who believes that there's a species of reptiles roaming the earth disguised as humans that are plotting to overthrow government.
Yeah, lizard people.
And right. And I was like, my heart sank, and I thought, God, what is... wrong with Robert Steele? He's saying this is a brilliant, insightful book. I mean, doesn't he know that this guy's a lunatic?
And his last name is literally Icky?
Right.
I mean, it's right there. It was right there in front of him.
But it's very sad. I mean, I could really empathize with what you guys were saying tonight. When you discover that somebody that you admire, you have great reverence for, and I could tell by the way you guys were speaking, you liked this guy, you respected him, and I remember attending that keynote he gave, very insightful and impressive, and you wonder, how does a person go wrong? I mean, so terribly wrong and start peddling this nonsense and very dangerous nonsense. you know, about COVID and that Trump is going to be reinstated, and it's very demoralizing.
We left out one, that there is a child enslavement colony on Mars. that's seriously, that's one of the things that he was talking about. Let me just ask you, you said you were at the first Hope keynote?
I was indeed, yes.
Wow.
I was at the first two, actually. I was at the one where he spoke, and then the one after that with Jello Biafra. Hopefully Jello Biafra hasn't gone off the deep end. I think he still has his, he's still pretty sane, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, Jello Biafra has been known to say some wacky things, but compared to the sorts of things that Robert Steele is embracing, he's Winston Churchill, you know. There's just no comparison. But yeah, you know, as you said, we respected him, we liked him, but not what he became. Not what he turned into.
Right.
And you'll see the period where we could not accept his talks anymore. We could not be a part of that. It just, he always had interesting theories and all kinds of wacky ways of expressing himself. As you may recall, he used to do the all-night Ask Me Anything, the Spy 101 thing at the Hope conferences. And there was all sorts of things he would talk about. But it just got to the point where he was embracing all sorts of insane conspiracy theories. And, you know, it's a valid question. In our community, how do we keep people from getting sucked into that world? Hackers, as a rule, are open to being wrong. They're open to all sorts of different perspectives. But people can take advantage of that. People can instill all kinds of craziness and make it seem like it has legitimacy. And then before you know it, there's people walking around saying that there's lizard people, you know, running the government.
Yeah.
I don't know. How do we do that? How do we fix this?
Well, I think maybe direct people towards some reputable fact-checking sites. I mean, that's one step. And also try to encourage people to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a two-pronged approach. I think we do have to focus on getting more people vaccinated. I just want to say in closing, as far as like people that you admire that spew really odious, reprehensible views later in life, I have to call out on the carpet Eric Clapton and Van Morrison, two of my favorite rock musicians, who have released a bunch of anti-lockdown songs. And I really love what these guys did in the 60s, but I really hate what they've become because they just sound like right-wing idiots denouncing lockdowns as government repression. And I think for two great musicians, they're really tarnishing their legacies.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I'm anti-lockdown, too. I don't want a lockdown, but, you know, I understand it might be the only way out of something. Are they anti-lockdown and anti-vaccine, or is it just they don't want to be cooped up inside and they want to go back on tour?
Well, they're anti-mask, too. I mean, Clapton more that, you know, he's expressing great skepticism about the vaccines. And, I mean, he had a bad experience with AstraZeneca. But, I mean, just if you Google them, you'll just see that, like, Van Morrison, his last album has, like, six anti-lockdowns. The whole album is anti-lockdown. And they're just talking about the government, that it's a form of brutal government repression. And
where are the anti-Trump songs? I was expecting a whole flurry of anti-Trump songs over the last 4 years. Instead, we're getting a bunch of anti-lockdown songs. I mean, come on, musicians,
right.
get it together.
It's very disheartening.
Uh-huh.
It really is. But I'm hoping things get better. And just keep up the great work, what you're doing. You guys are fantastic, and I love tuning into you every week.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the support. I think Alex has something to say. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, sure. I've got a few things to say in response to the caller, and thank you for the call. I think it was excellent. I would touch on every single one of the people that he mentioned very briefly. With respect to Eric Clapton, funny story about him is that one of my mentors, somebody who really took me under his wing, is a more senior lawyer to me, actually found his wife while she was Eric Clapton's girlfriend. And he stole her away from Eric Clapton and married her. So screw you, Eric Clapton, and your anti-lockdown song.
Wait a minute. Shouldn't Eric Clapton be the one saying screw you? if he stole, yeah, whatever, okay.
Well, you know, look, you know, it's water under the bridge at this point, I think. But insofar as I know, I think there may still be some acrimony. But going back to the caller's point, these anti-lockdown songs, and your points too, Emmanuel, there are obviously a lot on the other side. And I would direct the caller to check out Billy Bragg and some of his recent songs about the need to stay inside, which is, you know, a pro-lockdown song.
Okay, I didn't know about this. Billy Bragg, okay.
He has a great song that came out last year, I think last May or June, about not being able to go visit his mother. And, you know, I'm sorry I can't be there on Mother's Day because I don't want to bring that thing in that, you know, we don't really want to bring in, right? And the lyrics of it are really great. They're really moving, especially when you go and think back at that time. Maybe we can end with that,
If people can share with us any pertinent music that's coming out about any of this, please send it to OTH@2600.com. We have a New York City radio station. We'll be happy to play some of this.
Yeah, and maybe we should even have something like a running playlist for Off the Hook on something. But in any event, so the next person that he mentioned was David Ick. You know, I think we're calling him Icky, or some people call him David Ike. It's his last name is spelled I-C-K-E. So back when I was a student at Oxford, David Ick was invited to speak at the Oxford Union. And, you know, this is a while ago. It was probably about 14 years ago or so. And I mean, we're having the same debates then that we were now. I mean, people did not want David Icke to show up and espouse his crazy theories with respect to lizard people. And I believe that there was a major issue about his views on the Holocaust as well. And, you know, so ultimately, I do believe he came. I don't think it was really well attended, but you know, it did give this guy a lot of credence because you can go and look him up now and see that he went and spoke at Oxford University and was invited by the Oxford Union and gave a talk there. So, you know, giving a platform to these people can, on the one hand, legitimize them. And then the caller also mentioned going back in Hope history, Jello Biafra. And I was thinking about him during the show, too, because Jello Biafra, you know, the lead singer of Dead Kennedys, when he came and gave the Hope keynote, and then he wound up actually coming to my law school. I don't even think he was invited, but he showed up and talked to people until about 2 o'clock in the morning. But one of the main themes that Jello Biafra had said at numerous homes was that, you know, if we can't trust the media, if we can't trust their independence, well, now then we need to become the media. That was always one of his principles, was that individuals need to become the media. And this was the time of, you'll remember, Emmanuel, indie media, right? And so this notion of becoming the media, well, perhaps we are the media now when we have these massive platforms. We can amass these great followings. We can have people legitimize our online identity with something like a blue check mark that then amplifies our voice and our reach. And if we are the media now, then we have the responsibilities of the media as well. And that includes a responsibility to report the facts and to be accurate.
Yeah, but Alex, just on that point, I mean, that's nothing new. We have been the media. We're on a radio station. We publish a magazine. And when Jello says become the media, that's all fine and good for people who are qualified to do so. But when you say that and people hear it who have absolutely no qualification whatsoever and are going to spread all sorts of false information, I don't know if become the media is the right message anymore, because they're not legitimate media, and not everyone has that ability.
Oh, I think if you are the media, if you have that kind of influence on people, if you have that kind of following, obviously, then you have a greater form of responsibility. And maybe this is something that, you know, right now it's morally imposed and there's really no consequence to it at all, but perhaps, you know, this is something that will be legally imposed in the future as well, some kind of responsibility to investigate and report only facts. If we saw CNN reports of lizard people running the world and whatnot, I mean, we wouldn't stand for it. You know, it would be obviously false nonsense being reported as news. But you're right. If we are the media right now, maybe that's not such a great thing because, you know, we're not all a populace of trained journalists. But if we have that power, we have to have, I think, a corollary responsibility to act like the media does as well. And I just don't see those ethical duties matching up right now.
Yeah, and I think it's a responsibility really for actual journalists to find contributors and citizen reporters and verify the kinds of things that they're saying and help be have lower bars but still verify as sort of gatekeepers to sort of mainstream channels. And I think you're seeing that a lot more, especially with the amount of, like, people that are brought in to speak with teleconferencing and video. It's been very prevalent, of course, with distancing and stuff in the last year. But even beyond that, I mean, mainstream entities are working and active on the ground, but they also are able to talk to people who are familiar as, like, community organizers or people that are active on the scene, and allowing them to be sort of guest contributors. So I think that in that way, mainstream institutions are becoming a little bit more accessible to the sort of we are the media crowd in that we all have the tools of the media. We're not necessarily as qualified, but when I hear that phrase, I'm really more thinking of it as we have the capability of reporting, all of us do, and could at any one point, if it's a shooting or a police brutality or something, it's on us, because oftentimes there just isn't a reporter or someone there that can provide that in an authoritative way.
But, you know, I think fixing this is as challenging as fixing the cult behavior that people are being drawn to, because, you know, as soon as you say this is valid media, this is legitimate, well, someone else is going to pop up. There'll be a Fox News. And if there isn't a Fox News, then there'll be a Newsmax. And if that doesn't work, there's going to be something else. There's always going to be, in this day and age, a means for people to start a media organization that peddles lies. And it's nothing new. You know, this has been going on for as long as media existed, as arms of propaganda for the governments or corporations or political parties, all sorts of ways that you can be lied to. I'm sorry, caller, did you have any other points you wanted to bring up before we move on to somebody else?
No. Just thank you very much for a very stimulating, thoughtful discussion. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Care.
Take care. And please keep listening. Our phone number, 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACK.
That is a great point. Historically, I think the first printing press was used in many ways to find witches and, you know...
Lizard people.
Declare the
it always
lizard,
comes back to the lizard people.
The lizard sorcery of the time was used in the first affordable printing mechanisms when they're becoming prevalent. It wasn't just printing Bibles. People were using it for all kinds of specific ends that may or may not actually be as virtuous as they might reveal themselves. I mean, you've seen this a lot with, like, online newspapers and that seem like they have a storied reputation, but they just haven't existed long enough to kind of match their look. There's a lot of those kinds of fake kind of just clone news sites. I like to think of them as clones. And then also, like you said, clone networks of, like, oh, we're not as left as Fox. We're going to be even more to one side, and et cetera, et cetera. So that is because the barrier and the cost is so low.
I believe, if I know my area codes, we have a call from Missouri on the phone.
Do we?
Yeah.
This is Missouri on the phone. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. This is Phil from Missouri. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. About the conspiracy stuff, it doesn't matter what you tell them. They're just going to make up a conspiracy to cover for that conspiracy. They're just going to keep pushing the goalposts back.
Yeah, that's why the truth is not the answer. The truth is not going to set anyone free. It's not going to convince them. They're always going to have something else. So we have to find another means.
Well, in Australia, they have a show called Media Watch, right? So they'll review the week's news or daily or something like that. I don't know how to do it, but they'll go through and ABC, I think, in Australia is sort of like our Fox News.
I think they're a bit better than that. I think they're more mainstream than Fox News.
They're
yeah.
owned by the same company, I think.
Well, you know, they do it every week or every day or whatnot, and they call them out on stuff, and they've been calling out reality shows with their ads and stuff like that. Like, they'll sneak in, like, they have a bachelorette down there, too. So
there's a bachelorette everywhere.
Yeah. But they I think it was Zuzu was selling a truck. So they set up a date with the truck, and they had the guy actually talk about the truck when they were interviewing before the date. Things like that, but, you know, sometimes it just, I don't know if you ever, go on Facebook, on Fox News Facebook page. Earlier today, they were talking about, oh, Biden left all this equipment behind and everything else and getting everybody riled up on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, just like a couple hours ago, they also put up a story saying, well, the terrorists are mad because none of the equipment is working. And they got people riled up on that. So they're riling them up against two different sides of the same story, and it's just like your namesake, right? Where they, in 1984, where they're throwing cabbage at the movie screen because Manuel Goldstein is up there, right?
Yeah, the 2 minute hate.
It's exactly like it. I mean, it's really freaky.
The 2 minute hate, my favorite part of the day.
But you know, I don't know. Have you heard about the Twitch blackout tomorrow?
No, I don't know anything about that.
Okay, they have something going on when they're streaming. They have these, like, hate raids where a bunch of bots go into their, when they're streaming into their chat room and start spewing, like, racist stuff and stuff like that.
Okay.
So tomorrow, everybody on Twitch who's streaming, who's been getting this, they're going to just shut down for the day. They're boycotting Twitch for a day because Twitch takes half the revenue they get. Like, if you donate to them, like, $1, they get 50 cents from them or whatnot. And the ad revenue. So they decided they just had enough. If Twitch isn't going to stop anything like this, they'll just stop broadcasting for a day and just see if it hurts Twitch's bottom line or whatnot.
Okay. Well, that's I don't use Twitch. I'm not even sure what Twitch is, to be honest.
We did stream parts.
Well, it's like YouTube for gaming.
Okay, that's probably why I don't know.
Yeah, the conference was on Twitch for.
Okay,
the
conference wasn't a game.
We had some of the streams, I believe, syndicated. Tried it out. We're not as adept at using it. It was an experiment.
Got it.
Yeah, OBS is real easy to use with that.
Yeah, shout out to OBS, man. That is great software. We've had a lot of fun with that. I know a lot of people saved the day for them.
Yes, that's I do know that much.
The like quick setup for it is crazy, crazy good. Can't say enough about it. I'm sure others feel the same way.
Any other thoughts, caller?
Well, you ever seen Verbasium on YouTube? It's like a science channel.
I don't spend a lot of time on YouTube, and I certainly don't spend time on Facebook, so a lot of things I don't know.
Well, anyway, he was talking about, I think it was yesterday when he put it out, that cosmic rays can cause a bit flip on a chip.
Yes.
And it actually affected an election in Europe, like back in 96 or something like that. Because it wasn't the silicon they were using, something weird about it, and that they used to put the chip in itself, right? A cosmic ray like flip a bit and caused 4,000 votes to go one way or another. And I was just thinking, I wonder how long it would take for the Fox News crowd to pick up on that and start a conspiracy with that, with the election.
Well, it does sound like a conspiracy that, a bit flip because of cosmic rays. It just has that sound to it, but it happens to be scientifically true.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's ways of building in mechanisms to prevent random, like, bit rot and stuff like that happening.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a valid consideration.
All right, listen, thanks for your call. We're gonna try and take some more calls and also try to fix some technical problems. No, don't apologize. It's great hearing from you, and keep listening.
Okay, you have a good day.
Take care. Bye. Now, I understand our levels are... We can talk about this because we're not on the radio, so it's not unprofessional, even though we're not professional there either. We have low audio on YouTube. Is that correct, Rob?
Yeah, it's understandable if you peg the volume all the way up, but it's on the low side. It's lower than we want.
We have everything turned up, and that's should we just talk louder? We could do that. I don't know what else we can try. Kyle's tearing his hair out here. I mean,
a couple of listeners have pinged us to let us know, and thank you there. We always appreciate your emails, your messages, your tweets. to let us know when stuff like this is going on, or just to let us know what's on your mind.
We also have the ability to have the archive be of full volume, because I see the boils look good on our end, so we can always, maybe not on YouTube, but on the 2600.com archive, where we also keep an archive of this. Did you find anything, Kyle?
Yes.
Wait, you found the solution? Okay. Well, Kyle's walking back to his microphone now, which is about a half mile away from mine. When he gets there, he'll tell us what he found.
The input volume is a little bit lower because of some other projects we were working on that were sound-related.
Oh, wow. Okay. We do other things during the week, and sometimes that messes up these things. How does it sound now, Rob?
I think it's sounding better now. Yeah.
It sounds better. Okay, that's going to be problematic because now it's going to be half low and half high. But I guess we'll just have to live with it. You know, it's one of these things. It's one of these things. We'll be lucky if the roof doesn't cave in, because Ida is pouring rain on us right now. Are you getting rain in Queens, Rob?
We've been getting a little bit of rain and some heavy winds, but nothing worrisome.
Au contraire, there was a huge thunderclap in the middle of the show.
There was. That was fun.
Wow.
Like, we heard it.
You got thunder. You got thunder. We have no thunder out here on Long Island. How about Alex? Where are you?
I'm in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
And
did you get the storm?
I don't know if you saw, but towards the end of the show, I had to run out because a massive tree had fallen. We were having huge rainstorm here, combined with a tremendous amount of wind. And I heard this gigantic thump, just bang, that shook the house. And I was afraid that this huge tree that, you know, we realized, you know, needed to be cut down, might have fallen on the house. I think a huge portion of it might have actually hit the roof and then rolled off. So hopefully there's no damage.
Well, wait, you ran out to see, so you must know if there was any damage.
Well, it was dark, windy, and rainy. And, you know, it's the roof, right? So it's hard to tell.
Well, isn't that also what you expected, though, when you went outside? You knew it was dark and rainy and windy, and it was on the roof.
Yeah. Well, I took a cursory look, and everything seemed to be okay.
Okay.
But I think I will have to take a better look in daylight. I also, from the place where I had to stand to look at the roof of the house, was very close to where this gigantic trunk of the tree had fallen. So I didn't want to be over there for too long. Otherwise, I may not have returned to the show.
Interesting. So we're all going through the same storm. It's still raining up by you in Pennsylvania?
It is indeed. So it'll probably keep raining there at least for the next few hours.
This is a massive storm. You know, we were watching WWL, which is the local TV station in New Orleans. And, of course, a lot of people in New Orleans didn't have power, so they couldn't watch TV. But it was just fascinating to see how well they covered the crises that were going on throughout the entire multi-day crisis that New Orleans was going through, still is going through. And that's where I heard about the landlines, about how landlines pretty much weren't there and that they had lost communications because cell phones had died and cell phone towers, particularly AT&T, just simply failed. But all of this, it's all what we expect. You know, we should learn this by now, just like we should learn to use good passwords. We should learn about ways to protect our identity. It's really not anything late-breaking.
It's so sad to hear, too, because we're not even really getting at the corruption and greed that's involved in making these systems and lacking, like, the regulation. I don't know, one of the articles we had, I think it was the Tech Dirt article, was pretty scathing about AT&T's handling of that. And I want to go back to something that And that's just, we're just so charitable. We're just like, oh, we've been saying this for years, and gosh, we should embrace all kinds of things. No, they're
just
greedy, their system sucks.
Can I just read the headline from that TechDirt article? AT&T's 911 cellular networks faceplant in wake of Hurricane Ida. Yeah, it's a good article. I suggest reading it.
So true. And that just, like, we're not even going in hard on the bureaucratic and corporate aspect of it, which is lengthy, storied, and, I mean, for such a dominant, powerful, wealthy company to have failed so ingloriously there in an emergency is astounding and kind of makes sense.
It's predictable.
it kind of was bound to happen. because that's not where their interests are. They're making shareholders happy, and they set prices with all their other cronies for all the other networks and elbow out any kind of regulation. This is what happened when Ajit Pai was running the FCC for years, and Powell before him, into the ground. And other than selling spectrum, I don't know what other good they do. Maybe harassing radio stations, but it's really pathetic. And we deserve better as a country. And we're tired of being blue in the face talking about it. And it's not our fault. I'm tired of blaming myself for all of these externalities and being like, oh, well, maybe we just should have messaged better or
how do you message better?
Held people's hands harder. You know, like, give me a break. This marketplace sucks. I'm tired of commenting on it. It's boring. I want to talk about making older telephone systems cool and, you know, old technology great, you know. But I'm very frustrated hearing that there's suffering as a result of this, and yet no consequence, no blame, and here we are just expounding in the most aspirational, altruistic terms when there's real failings at the foundation of this, in my view.
Well, this might make you feel better. The chief executive of America's second largest wireless network apologized to millions of customers who had their data stolen in a hack of the company's systems. The hack resulted in the exposure of personal information, including names, driver's license numbers, and social security numbers of as many as 40 million current and former T-Mobile customers. No credit card information was lost. They say that as if that's something we should be celebrating. Why do they have our social security numbers? Why do they have our driver's license numbers? There's no reason to give them that information. There's no reason they should ask you for that information. It's a telephone. You pay your bill, you continue to have the telephone. You stop paying it, they disconnect you, period. That's it. They don't need to know where you live. They don't need to know anything. And yet somehow we've told ourselves we have to give them all this information. Well, this is what happens when you give them the information. They lose it. They share it with people they're not supposed to share it with. And you're the one that winds up paying for it. CEO Mike Sievert said in a blog post on Friday, "We didn't live up to the expectations we have for ourselves to protect our customers." You sure didn't, and you continue not to, and you're not alone. And that goes for utility companies, that goes for all kinds of media outlets that simply don't keep information as secure as they should. It's not hard, but... Well, I mean, it is hard. It's a hard job, but it's not hard to know this, you know, to realize this is where you have to focus attention. And I just wish they took it more seriously. Alex?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll push back against that a little bit. I think, you know, we have to be careful of blaming the victim. I know we talked about this already.
We are the victim, Alex. T-Mobile and AT&T are not the victims. They're the culprits.
Right.
They're the ones with the data letting it go and not caring enough to protect it. So they are not the victims here.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, look, as somebody, as a security practitioner, too, you know, it's hard to say whether they're the culprit or not without knowing, you know, what kind of controls they had in place. How did this happen? Whether there was some form of negligence involved. But it is. It's a very difficult thing. And I agree. I think data should be minimized to the extent possible, and that's a lot of what the practice of privacy law and privacy engineering is all about these days. But it's very, very hard.
Can you think of a single good reason that a phone company needs your social security number?
Yeah, to use it to run some kind of periodic credit check on you, something like that, where
that's
that information
Your name can do that. Social security should be for social security. That's my understanding.
Well, maybe it's to verify. Maybe it's another piece of information used to verify your identity.
And why do they need to verify your identity? Why can't I get a phone under an assumed name? Why is that so important, Gila?
Why have credit scores become the most important thing in the country in the past 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Why are we feeding into that? You know,
we're not asking the right questions. These are the right questions to ask. We're assuming these things are normal, and they're really not.
I think that's a huge piece of it. Is credit scores didn't really exist before, 1989?
No, actually, it was about 1985, 1984. Well, I know because 2600 did a report on this in 1984, but I don't know if they were credit scores or simply credit reports at the time with TRW.
I think I was seeing something that, like, FICO really came into prominence in 1989. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, that determines so much. Like, if you can have a phone, where you can live, sometimes if you can get a job.
Right.
And why are we allowing this to be the arbiter of what the world is and what our place is in it, and also handing over this kind of personally identifiable information?
Yeah, yeah. As often as possible, I give fake information to these companies, and I sleep well at night. it's morally, I think it's just fine to do that. If the bill is paid, that's all they should care about. It's just insane to have these companies demanding personal information that really is none of their business. Our phone number 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACKER on Off the Hook Overtime for another few minutes. If there's something you'd like to share with us or get off your chest, by all means, give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. 802-321-4225. Yes, Rob.
While we're waiting for a call, I wanted to ask you about today's Lost Audio, which I enjoyed a lot.
Oh, you're following that. Yeah, Lost Audio is something that we're doing on 2600.com. Every day since July 15th, we release a snippet of audio that has one way or another been lost, either an interview, an old radio show, various things like that. Today, we released a 1987 interview that I did with two members of Big Audio Dynamite, which Don Letts and Dan Donovan. This took place at Irving Plaza. It's interesting because it happened the day after I got back from this week-long trip to Baffin Island up in Iqaluit, in what was then Northwest Territories, what's now Nunavut. So the contrast from going to a remote northern city to the middle of New York City and seeing my favorite band, it couldn't have been more dramatic. And these two guys were just so amazing to talk to. They just were so gracious and open and intelligent, and it was really a cool thing. Unfortunately, you'll hear at the end of that same recording, we made the mistake of asking, was Adam Yauch of Beastie mm-hmm. Boys for an ID, and it was just the most misogynistic, sexist, obscene thing. And we included it because, hey, it was part of the night, you know, it's there, it's what happened, it was unacceptable then, it's unacceptable now, but there it is. It's not always pleasant, but the interview and subsequent interviews that I did with Big Other Dynamite were simply high points, and I realized just what amazing people they were, more than just musicians. So that's one day. Tomorrow we'll release something else. And I think this is going to go on well into October, where we have just all kinds of different pieces. Have you been listening to them?
I've been listening on and off every so often, catching up on the ones I missed. But yeah, I saw the Big Audio Dynamite interview, and I think you've had like a little snippet of that available before elsewhere. But it's a good interview, and yeah, also Mick Jones, I think, trying to do an ID and calling the station WUSP.
Yeah, the station's WUSB, and he said WUSP. Yeah. That's why we never used that ID. But I didn't have the heart to ask him to do it again.
Yeah.
But actually, that interview has never been aired anywhere. You're thinking of a 1989 interview I did with them.
I was thinking of the IDs. I think you put those.
The
up
IDs, yeah. Some of the IDs made it, not the Adam Yash one, but
yeah.
Other ones did. But yeah, it's fascinating. A lot of this came from old tapes or old files that were just sitting around, and it took many months to organize them and get them together and figure out a release schedule. And then, of course, we had our webmaster genius Olsi, who put together a system where we could have these things released in a way that made sense. And you know what? There might be more, and maybe listeners have more audio that we've lost track of. If you think you have something, write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear just what kinds of material you might have.
Yeah, before we do the wax cylinder encoding project, we need to get all the tapes so we can move past tape, and we'll switch media.
You know, we have a wax cylinder machine, and we have some wax cylinders. Have you guys ever seen wax cylinders? It's like little Alexas. It's the shape of the tubular Alexa, a little bit shorter, and then they go into a machine, and that was pre vinyl. That's how they got the latest singles or music or whatnot. I've yet to actually hear one, but it's prevalent. You can buy these wax cylinders online. They're pretty cheap.
Yeah, they're pretty groovy.
Yeah.
And it would be fun to learn about it and maybe figure out a way to record our own wax cylinder.
Wouldn't that be cool? Okay, so
that's a great premium, right?
Yeah, yeah. who was it who made the album for like $1 million? And
Wu-Tang.
Yeah, Wu-Tang Clan. Mm. Why don't they release their next album on a wax cylinder? That'll be a challenge for people to actually hear it.
They're probably already working on it.
Of course, I don't know what the fidelity is, so it might not be the best. But
you know, we could drive out to Staten Island and pitch it to the Wu-Tang Clan.
You know, I might as well ask this, too, since we have a captive audience, literally. We're working on a vinyl encoding project, vinyl through USB, and digitize some vinyl collections. And we're having a heck of a time finding a good setup, a phonograph with a decent USB output that saves to a WAV format, and that doesn't do things like distort or have a tone arm that skips all over the place. You know, a decent turntable with a decent USB output. That's what I'm looking for. If anyone has any suggestions, again, write to us, oth@2600.com. This is one of many, many projects that we are involved in.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's this weird confluence of old and new, kind of along the lines of what we'd been addressing in the show, just having old stuff but wanting to make an index or make it accessible in a new player, this being computers and file formats. So it's really exciting, but you also run into all this stuff, and this was partly why, one of the reasons the input was set low. We were troubleshooting some gain issues, and there's a trade-off, because you can get like the most impressive DAW, which is digital audio workstation, and you can find the most esoteric audiophile turntable in the world that's like balanced on fine rare gems and stuff, but we're not quite as interested. We just want it to not sound terrible and work with some kind of USB encoding so that we don't have to get an expensive audio interface, which is totally possible. We do a lot with that anyway with radio, and there are a couple. We're going to experiment. We're still experimenting and trying to find something we're happy with. But some of the cheaper software and other packages out there work great for what we need, but they don't have as much variability in the kinds of inputs. It's weird, and audio recording with USB is weird. So we're not totally sold on that either. It's an interesting project, but it's important because it allows you to know what you have in your collection. Like if you have a library, you want to quickly search through what titles and go grab an album or find out what album the song was on. It would really complement that. And we know there's so many hackers out there that have done probably way more complicated encodings, and we just want to find out what's worked for people and then maybe share it, because we also do so much with the radio stations. We've seen what places like WFMU and other places have done with record libraries and stuff, so it's a really important kind of technical initiative, kind of like our voicemail system, voice BBS system, where we're organizing all those recordings. That's what you do. You bring it into a new format, bring it into a new era, so that it's not just locked on some media.
Yeah, absolutely. Have we gotten any calls? 802-321-4225. We're going to leave it open for another couple of minutes. I wasn't looking, but I don't think I heard it.
If you're in a storm-affected area.
As we are right now.
But if you just weathered a storm, please call us. Tell us how it went.
And we know that the phone works. A landline will work in rain. Can't always say that about cell phones. But
we want to know like what kinds of things you're going through, if you need anything, what kind of messages you might want to get out about how hard it is to communicate. We're here. We'd love to share. I'm sure it might be hard to listen to us, but you know, if you can listen to us, you could probably maybe find a way to reach out.
Yeah, that's well said. This story here, which I found kind of interesting and perplexing at the same time, a hacker has returned $336,000. A lot of hackers returning money lately. This hacker returned $336,000 to a British collector after he tricked him into buying a fake Banksy NFT advertised through the artist's official website. Yeah, a link to an online auction for the NFT was posted on a now-deleted page of Banksy.co.uk. The auction ended early after the man offered 90% more than rival bidders. Banksy's team told the BBC, any Banksy NFT auctions are not affiliated with the artist in any shape or form. In case you don't know, with NFTs, artwork can be tokenized to create a digital certificate of ownership that can be bought and sold, but they do not generally give the buyer the actual artwork or its copyright. Yeah, we'll come back to that. The Banksy fan who got duped says he thought he was buying the world-famous graffiti artist's first ever NFT. The man who is in his 30s and wanted to remain anonymous, and I can understand why, explained over Twitter direct messages that he suspects Banksy's site was hacked and he was the victim of an elaborate scam. He says the hacker returned all the money except for the transaction fee of around £5,000 on Monday evening. And honestly, I think whoever charged the £5,000 should return that. Why is it that those guys get to keep it? You know, whoever they are, that's just not right. The prominent NFT collector uses the online name Pranksy, and he said the whole episode was bizarre, but that the hacker may have gotten scared. Or you know what? Maybe the hacker was just honest and wanted to teach you a lesson. Your name is Pranksy, after all. I feel very lucky when a lot of others in a similar situation with less reach would not have had the same outcome. Oh, so it's your reach that did it. This guy does not want to give the hacker any credit. It's because of who you were and because you scared the hacker. Yeah. So basically, this opens up the whole question of NFTs. People have explained NFTs to me dozens of times, and I still don't get it. I still don't understand it. I don't understand the value, the allure. You don't own the artwork. You don't have the artwork. You own a certificate that says that you're the person that has the certificate or something like that. Alex, you're a legal expert. You're a lawyer. Does this make any sense to you?
Oh, God.
Good. That's what I want to hear. No, I want to hear that tone because that's how I feel.
I know. I mean, yeah, the whole NFT thing is very, it's bizarre in a lot of ways, and I get it that you don't own the physical manifest, the physical thing itself.
But isn't that the whole point, is the physical thing itself? Why would you want to own anything else?
Well, look, there is, there's something to be said, though, about, you know, owning this singular digitalization. It's basically, you know, creating this spot, you know, where the thing exists, where this digital presence of a spot, you know, on a blockchain of where this thing exists, and you knowing that you own the only digital manifestation.
And how do you know that? How do you know you own the only one? How do you know no one else can just do the same thing again somewhere else?
Well, you know, I that's what I've wondered a lot too, right? That, you know, sure, you can just, you know, put random data in a blockchain and track it and things like that, but it is, you know, having the scarcity of this one unique and particular digital item, you know, and you may be able, obviously you can create other digital incantations of the particular thing itself, but they won't be the official one, that one that is, because it's weird for us to say this because we're just so used to things being copied in digital form, but this is a unique thing that exists in the digital space. Even though we may be able to make graphic representations, this one digital incantation, owning that for some reason, attracts a lot of value.
Kyle, then Rob.
Well, I just think of it as a way of making things that are infinitely copyable, like digital files, making them unique in attaching this token or cryptographic scheme that in itself can allow the owner to verify that they are the owner, or allow others that are wanting to verify their ownership or possession of this unique file. But I think it's still emerging, and there's a lot of different ways of thinking about it, and it's also as valuable as people as much value as they attach to it. So at this point, maybe something isn't as sought after, or it's just sort of affordable and people are just having fun with it, and maybe the attitude towards that unique item changes over time. And I think that's what people are betting on in a lot of ways, if that makes sense.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, there's a lot of if that makes sense in the NFT world, but the problem is none of it makes sense. To break it down very simply, NFTs have nothing to do with the actual artwork other than just attaching the fact of their existence to a little number somewhere that you can buy on someone else's list. It's like if I tell you I'm selling the Mona Lisa and you say the Mona Lisa's in the Louvre in Paris, you can't be selling the Mona Lisa. No, I'm selling you the Mona Lisa. And so you give me like $1,000 for the Mona Lisa, and I say, in exchange for that $1,000, I will write your name on a piece of paper in my little notebook that I have here and say, Gila owns the Mona Lisa because Gila just bought the NFT.
Oh, how convenient.
Gila doesn't get the Mona Lisa. Gila has nothing to do with the Mona Lisa, which is still hanging in the Louvre. If anyone wants to look at my little notebook and see Gila's name in it, I'll show them too.
Well,
and that's what Gila's just paid $1,000.
Yeah, let me ask you, Rob, what gives you the right to do that?
Absolutely nothing. There have been cases now of licensed NFTs, like the new Totally Garbage Space Jam movie that came out. The movie studio put out their own NFTs of stuff from the movie. And, they're not selling anything except writing people's names in a little notebook. And the only thing that makes it any flavor of official is that it's the same people who made the movie doing the thing, but still, there is no thing being owned, apart from bragging rights that you can say, oh, you bought it first. But even if, say, Gila, you bought the Mona Lisa's NFT from me in my little notebook,
mm-hmm.
that's not stopping anybody else in the world from pulling out their little notebook and saying, no, I'm going to sell you the Mona Lisa. How much will you buy for that?
So then you're not the official owner because there could be a million official owners.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's the new version of selling the Brooklyn Bridge to people. And it's absolutely...
Wait a minute. Has anyone done that? Has anyone actually done an NFT of the Brooklyn Bridge? Because that's perfect.
Oh, that must have happened, I'm sure. But, like, as a working artist, as somebody who, has designs of doing artwork in exchange for money to make a living, it baffles me so much that people are willing to pay people with nothing to do with the artist a bunch of money to say, okay, I now have some kind of dibs on that piece of artwork, when you can just actually buy art and support people who make these things.
Okay,
and,
idea. WBAI applies to the FCC, changes its call letters to WNFT. Okay, and then they just go around the city making NFTs of everything and selling them for huge amounts of money to people that just don't like their money as much as they like to have digital representations.
And then make it part of the fund drive.
There won't be a fund drive. There won't be a need for one. It'll just be a constant flow of income from people that I don't understand. Wow.
I can't help but wonder, though, if there's an NFT bubble and it's going to burst soon.
There seems to be, like, waves of more and more people kind of who got caught up in this whole thing. Now, like this person, looking at this NFT thing and going, what have I actually got here? And what did I just pay money for? And, like, ending up dissatisfied with the whole thing.
But on what planet would you think that Banksy, of all people, was going to, like, show up in some random place and be like, hey, dude, have an NFT. What?
Yeah.
At the same time, he's pulled stunts like that.
With the paper shredder. But
with the paper shredder with like, just randomly selling artwork out in the street somewhere.
Yeah,
and
but
without
this
saying
is
it was
like the dude on the Catfish show who thought he was dating Katy Perry.
Right. And
it's not happening.
Yeah, but it's, and you know, there are ways to buy art. There are ways to support people who create things. And also, as a working artist, the power of the internet and the power of the digital space for artists is that stuff can be copied. You can put your stuff out there and people can build on it. And, you have freely licensed stuff that people are encouraged to remix. And, this is just so far in the other direction, it's not even funny.
I think for Banksy's site specifically, because of his anonymity and stuff, that it's managed through other people and it's hosted through a separate provider. So it is entirely likely that somehow that system or service provider had some kind of vulnerability and someone was able to exploit it and add a page to what is a very small website, essentially. So it's certainly possible, but if you're Banksy, why would you say either way? Why would you say, like, oh, my site just got compromised and this NFT isn't really me? He'll probably just ride it out like any other prank he's done, and it just sort of fits in personally perfectly with his sort of persona in a lot of ways. So maybe he is messing with it. Maybe he wants to make a mockery of the very idea of NFTs and high art, because that's kind of his thing.
Yeah. Well, maybe the hacker is Banksy or somebody that. But something tells me that I don't know. Was his website hacked? There's a lot of questions here. You know, I might have shaken Banksy's hand once. You know, that time in New York. Remember when he was putting out a different art installation every day? It was a magical time. There was this one time where there was this truck going around with what was it?
Animatronic animals singing, and they were all like laughing, but they were in a meat truck.
In a meat truck, and I saw it coming by, and I just was so happy to see that. And the person driving it, I just, you know, reached my hand out and shook his hand, and it could very well have been Banksy, because that's the kind of thing Banksy would do, is drive his own truck.
Yeah,
I could totally see that.
That's so. Details.
Let me have that. Okay,
all about details.
There's that possibility. But you know, just a conclusion to this story, how serious this could have been. Tom Robinson from cryptocurrency analysts or analysis company Elliptic confirmed there was nothing the buyer could do once they placed their bid on the auction platform OpenSea. OpenSea is the eBay of NFTs. I'll say that again for dramatic effect. OpenSea is the eBay of NFTs. Well, I can imagine a 1990s version of me wondering what the hell I just said. It allows anyone to sell digital art that they own or have created themselves. Once a bid has been placed, the seller can accept, and the cryptocurrency is irreversibly transferred. That is just so scary when you consider all the money that was involved here, and the person didn't even own the art that he allegedly sold. Wow. Be careful with NFTs. I don't see the advantage.
Yeah, it just sounds like a complicated receipt.
It does. That's pretty much what it is. But if you have ideas for interesting uses for NFTs, we're all ears. We'll definitely listen. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. I guess we're going to wrap it up for tonight. Any final words from anybody out there? Alex, Gila, Rob?
2600 meetings are happening in various forms throughout the world on Friday. You know, if your local meeting is happening in person again, you have that option. Otherwise, a lot of meetings are still doing online alternatives.
Yes. In fact, tomorrow there will be an updated list on 2600.com/meetings. If you're in a country where the vaccination rate is 40% or above, then it's okay in our eyes to start your meetings again, as long as you observe some cautionary behavior. And we're slowly starting to populate the meetings again. I know New York is... how have the meetings gone in New York so far, Rob?
They've been going well. I mean, we've done two of them now in person in an outdoor space, in front of the front entrance of the atrium on 53rd Street and 3rd Avenue. And we're going to do that again this week. And it's been going well. I know, unfortunately, and I don't have permission to give out names or anything, but unfortunately there are a couple of people who are regulars at our events and have been for ages who are now fighting Delta. So, you know, just anonymously going to send some good vibes out in that direction. Yes, you're encouraged to, if you're vaccinated and if you're interested in meeting up in person again, come out to the atrium on Friday and check it out. The info will be on nyc2600.net. And if you're not into coming out in person, there will still be an online teleconference version for people to do from home.
And not to get too much personal information here, but do you know if those people were vaccinated?
I know one of them was. I'm not sure if both of them were. I've heard of two people. But one of them is definitely a breakthrough case.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that happens and is probably would have been much worse had they not been vaccinated.
Yeah, the breakthrough cases, which I'm seeing more of than I think we all expected, it doesn't prove that the vaccine doesn't work. It proves that the virus is mutating into something stronger. That's what it proves, and that, as you said, it would have been so much worse if people were not vaccinated. So I hope people who have not yet gotten the vaccination, please spare no time and get it ASAP, because it could get a lot worse before it gets better. And you know, my other thought is that perhaps the answer to the virus is the virus. In other words, a mutation that cancels out a previous mutation that isn't as harmful to us. that might be the only way that it disappears. And that is how viruses of the past have somehow petered out, not through human intervention, but just somehow I don't want to say it defeats itself, but sometimes it goes in a better direction, and it doesn't always get worse for spreading or for fatalities or things like that. That is not something to count on. That's definitely not something to count on. But in this day and age where, you know, we're meeting such resistance, I have to hold out hope that there'll be some kind of solution that we haven't thought of yet.
Well, with such wishful thinking for virus mutations, I think probably a great spot to end the evening and say good night, everybody, and thank you for listening, and be nice to each other. Let's get vaccinated and be nice to the unvaccinated if you're around them.
Be nice to each other. Have a safe and healthy long weekend if you're off for Labor Day. If you are celebrating a new year next week, we wish you happy and healthy, and please be careful, right? Yeah, happy new year to those people for whom it applies. Enjoy your Labor Day for those whom it doesn't. That's all I got.
Okay. And we'll see you guys next week. Night, everybody.